Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to episode 8 of Film Club here on Invasion Radio, right at screeninvasion.com. As usual, I'm Mal Foster, and I am, of course, as usual, joined by Mr. Daniel Seraph. How are you doing, sir?
I'm good. How are you, Mal?
I'm not too bad, thank you. Not too bad at all. And, of course, we are here to watch films together and to talk about films together. And this week, we are talking about Unforgiven, which... the following program will have many spoilerific comments about the film, so if you haven't seen it yet, put us on pause, go watch the film, check it out, come back, listen to us talk about it, and then let us know your thoughts and feelings as well over at Facebook, Screen Invasion, at the Film Club forums. Very easy to do, and it would be great to have you on board. But seeing as this was your pick, Dan, I'm going to let you introduce the film.
Yeah, sure, okay. Basically, Unforgiven is the film that Clint Eastwood won his Best Picture Oscar for, alongside Million Dollar Baby, of course. Mm-hmm. I think it was maybe 12 years later. The film is a Western released in 1992, and it's about this retired old Western hero whose name is William Money, who basically takes one last final job to go and kill a bunch of people who, oh, I think it's just two people actually, mm-hmm. who attacked some prostitutes in a little town called Big Whiskey. And he goes with the help of a partner, played by Morgan Freeman, and another kind of young gunslinger who's the nephew of someone that I believe William Money was acquainted with. Mm-hmm. His name was Schofield Kid.
Yeah.
And basically, it takes all the conventions of a Western film, but then turns them on its head. And that's why I chose Unforgiven for this week's film club, because it doesn't just follow the stereotypical path of a Western with all the archetypal Western characters. In fact, it has a lot of stuff to say that goes against what Westerns would usually do. It's a film that doesn't celebrate violence. It doesn't celebrate the kind of Western action hero who comes into town, like gunslinging on the back of a horse, you know, to kind of save the day. It's more kind of mediation on, you know, regret and remorse, and about also how violence doesn't solve anything. And so I thought it was a really interesting film to pick for this week's film club. And it's one of my favorite Western films, actually, because it takes, like I said, all the conventions and then spins them on their head, basically.
Mm-hmm. I would absolutely agree. This is the first time I saw this film, so I sat down and quite excited, because I always like when we have films that I've not seen before. As much as I like rewatching stuff and kind of watching with another eye, it's always always exciting to sit down with a film that I'm watching for the very first time. And I gotta be honest, from the first scene, I'm gripped, and I'm in this thing right until the very end, and I just absolutely loved it. And I loved it because of how it does exactly what you said. It takes a lot of sort of cardboard cut out conventions from Western films of old, and it kind of turns them on their head, and it makes it almost a Western slash anti-Western in many mm-hmm. ways. I love the fact that it just blurs the lines, and there is no clean cut good or bad throughout. I mean, in a lot of traditional Westerns, the sheriff of a small town is often looked at as like a pinnacle of good, like a beacon of hope. In this, he's just a shit. He is a really nasty guy who doesn't really care about anyone or the town. And it's just like, this isn't normally how it goes. This is kind of, and it's a little weird at first, but it's very refreshing once you get yourself sort of settled into the way that they kind of make it a little bit topsy-turvy. But I just love the way they blurred the lines, and it kind of goes against the grain of what you're expecting to see and feel.
Yeah, it does. I mean, right from the opening shot, you basically kind of get that idea, because, I mean, the opening shot is this kind of almost kind of visual homage to The Searchers and that kind of famous silhouette of John mm-hmm. Wayne stood in the doorway. And, you know, Searchers is a film about you kind of archetypal Western hero going out and killing Indians. You know, it's that kind of film, whereas Unforgiven opens up with the same kind of silhouette shot, but of this old man burying his wife. And you sort of get that feeling straight away that, you know, this isn't going to be your typical standard affair. Instead, this is going to be something more realistic and grounded in reality, and, you know, with characters that don't just kind of fit the action hero persona. They're a lot more real than the kind of ones you would usually see in a Western film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think because it kind of does the alternative and it kind of takes a different slant, I do think it makes a lot of the characters a lot more real. Because the thing is, as good as old westerns of yesteryear were and still are, it kind of is a little bit too clean cut, and it kind of feels like there's not an awful lot of depth to a lot of the characters, and you get that in the bucket load with this film. Just to kind of tie on to you talking about the opening shot, that's the first thing I made a note of, was that it's actually like a very sad scene in the sense that you see, like you said, this old man marrying his wife, but the actual visual aesthetic of that shot is really beautiful. In fact, I put in my notes "gorgeous opening shot" because to me it was. I think just that color palette, just the framing of it was just a really beautiful shot to open with. And then it jumps to something that is completely contrasting. It jumps straight into the story where you see the two guys that are being hunted, you see them cutting up the prostitute's face, and it's just really kind of intense and grim. And I'm like, although it's along the same lines tonally of what's being told here, it's a complete different thing to the visual aesthetic of what you've just seen literally a few seconds ago. You've gone from this really beautiful sort of opening shot to this really grim, nasty, intense, ugly kind of looking scene.
Yeah, it does that a lot. I mean, that's one of the cool things about the film. I mean, most westerns are very picturesque, full of beautiful imagery and great cinematography, and Unforgiven does that, but also manages to do it while blending it with some really, really dark stuff. Like, of course, the opening scene. Well, not the opening scene, but the second scene with the two cowboys cutting up the prostitute. And you also get it towards the end of the film in the kind of final action sequences. It's very murky and dark and dirty and grim, the imagery in that scene, and it does do that contrast really, really well. And again, it sort of is part of that theme of blurring the lines between, this kind of character who in a past life was maybe your kind of archetypal Western hero, but then is looking back on the crimes that he committed and the actions that he did back in those days, and is looking back on them with remorse and regret, and he wishes that he didn't live that kind of life, and is looking for almost sort of a redemption now. And so it does that contrast between, the picturesque kind of cliches of Western and the gritty, grim reality of that kind of violence really, really well.
Yeah, it does, because I mean the kind of character that William Money used to be is the kind of character that is, the hero, the protagonist, the person you're supposed to root for in Westerns of old. And I thought it was a really interesting concept that here is this guy that's had this life that, may have been glamorized in the West of old, but he's actually looking back on it with remorse and with regret, and he sees that as a darker time in his life. One of the things that I thought was really interesting was it jumps straight into the film. I mean, there's no sort of dilly-dallying, for lack of a better phrase.
Yeah, no, I understand.
It just literally jumps straight in. And one thing that I thought was really interesting, and it's something that is great within the context of the film, but it also makes a very significant and quite interesting and loud statement that the value of people really is not worth an awful lot in comparison to the value of money, because when the two perpetrators of the act are caught and confronted by Little Bill Daggett, who we'll get into in a little bit, they kind of barter for the actual justice of what's gone on. And instead of actually punishing the people for this crime against a person, they come up with this idea that they're gonna just punish them with like fiscal benefits. And it kind of really struck home that this was quite a profound statement in its opening gambit, and I really like that.
Yeah, and that scene also plays really well with the kind of the meaning of the title as well, because there's a scene later on, of course, when Delilah, who is the one upon like the attack was committed, the attackers obviously ride back into town a little bit later on, and they offer their horses as as a payment for their crime. And then the youngest one of the two attackers offers an extra pony to her, and you get this look that Delilah gives at this point, where it's implied that she's sort of forgiven these people and accepts their apology, and would is gonna happily accept the pony as a kind of forgiveness. But the other prostitutes don't really want to forgive these people. They would rather see bloodshed. They'd rather see violence. They'd rather like hire out a Western gunslinger outlaw to go and kill these people. And that idea of kind of forgiveness and unforgiveness, obviously with the title, is a big part of the story. Like William Money is someone who doesn't forgive himself for his violent actions. Neither does Ned in a similar way. And you get the feeling with that scene with Delilah and with the horses that, if they'd all kind of realized at that point that, that there is more important things than retribution and violence, and that they didn't have to have all this blood on their hands, then things would have worked out a lot easier. Whereas, obviously, in the film, it doesn't work out that way, and there is a lot of violence, and nobody really has a happy ending or a conclusion to it. And it all, like I said, it all kind of ties into this idea of forgiveness and unforgiveness, and that the violence doesn't really solve anything. And it's a really interesting concept that's thrown at us straight away in the very opening of Unforgiven, I thought.
I'm glad you pulled out that scene with Delilah and the horses, because I thought that was actually a really standout moment in the film. And I think it's a standout moment that ties in with this sort of theme that I picked up in the film, is that Unforgiven is actually a very pro-female film. Whereas I'm not saying that in the past every Western was misogynistic, but it was certainly more based around the template that the West was a man's world and women were kind of allotted to certain roles. And I feel with Unforgiven, it kind of, that again is something that it turns on its head, because as you said, you have Delilah, who has this real quiet strength about her considering what she's gone through, but she has this quiet strength about her, and that scene in particular is fantastic because you've got all of the other prostitutes who are just heckling and getting really rowdy and angry and aggressive, and they're still, bowing for blood. Whereas she, as you say, gives, it's just this very, very slight look, like you mentioned, and it is almost as if she's kind of saying it's okay, and there's a real sort of quiet strength about that and about her persona as well. But I also thought the fact that these women kind of defy their, for lack of better terms, their owner or their pimp, I guess it would be Skinny the pimp, and kind of offer up a bounty, like they take measures into their own hands. I found that actually a very sort of powerful mechanism and a kind of very pro-female thing. And the whole thing that William basically says that his wife was his savior, he had this life of treachery and bad doings. And he has this problem with alcohol that he's had in the past, and she has been the reason that has helped him to stop that and brought him back to a sort of life of more purer endeavors. I thought that was actually really empowering. I think there's just little bits throughout the film which really kind of strike up a chord as a pro-female view.
Yeah, it's interesting that Delilah is probably the only hero in a story. Like, as we mentioned before, Westerns are usually kind of black and white morality tales. You have like the hero and the villain. Whereas here, most of the main protagonists are none of those things. I mean, they do blur the lines many times between being the good guy and the bad guy, but Delilah's the only person that really comes across as someone who throughout the film is doing the right thing. And it is a great kind of spin on the fact that, most Westerns from like the Sergio Leone movies to like the John Ford movies, there weren't many female characters. And if they did, they performed their kind of female duties, quote unquote. They were the wives, the mothers, they were the prostitutes who would kind of give relief to these cowboys like on their journeys. They just were the providers, whereas Delilah feels like the hero of this in a way, someone who is doing the right thing and is on the right path and, is someone who doesn't want violence and doesn't want bloodshed and is just trying to do the right thing,
And what's interesting is she, out of everyone, has the most reason to want vengeance and redemption and violence caused for the actions, because it's her that this horrible act has been sort of caused upon. Yet she is the least like that, and I thought that was a really interesting dynamic to her character.
Yeah, it is. Like I said, I mean, she's the one upon whom the attack was done, and she wants to forgive these people. She would happily accept the pony and take their apology and, have things done with it, but it's the other people that want violence, and in the end, it's them that have blood on their hands. in so to speak.
I mean, thematically, I think that whole essence of her character is fantastic because where it's seen as other characters as like a sign of weakness, ultimately it's the probably the strongest thing any of the characters actually do in the film is that whole scene.
Exactly. That's the thing. Like, we've usually got used to seeing violence as this kind of strong bravado thing in Western movies, and yet in here it's shown to be, wanting to keep the peace and forgive. That's the strongest kind of thing that you can do in this film. And most of the characters that are shown to be the kind of bravado, tough, strong heroes are eventually shown out to be cowards and drunkards and frauds. And it's another thing that Unforgiven does, kind of, just destroying the Western myth.
Oh yeah, it just kind of obliterates a lot of the mythos that we've kind of come to accept.
Yeah, exactly. And like, one of my favorite sequences in the film, and it's weird because the first time I watched Unforgiven, I wasn't really taken with the sequence, but it's the English Bob part of the movie. Because at first I was like, kind of like, well, what did that really do to the narrative? That didn't really take the story anywhere, but thematically, that section has everything to do with Unforgiven. It says everything that you need to know about what Unforgiven's trying to do. He's this honorable, ruthless, strong type who, in any other movie, and at the start when he's introduced, he's kind of the cool, admirable character. But of course, during that segment, he is shown to be a complete fraud who shot an innocent man in a way while he was drunk over a girl that he liked. He wasn't the kind of Duke of Death, as they call him in his biography. In fact, like they actually, Gene Hackman's character mocks him as the Duck of Death, which, it's just part of a theme of kind of taking the Western myth and just turning it on its head. I mean, it's the same thing with the Schofield kid as well, saying that he's killed five people and he's, the nephew of this old West gunslinger, and but then he's just a kid who can't really see very far, hasn't got a good shot, hasn't killed anyone, and when the time comes, freezes and can't do the job. It's those kind of characters that are shown to be cowards and frauds, and it's the ones that want to keep the peace, like Delilah, who are shown to be the heroes here.
I'm really pleased you brought up English Bob because I can understand where you might think, well, hang on, at first this seems a little bit of a diversion, but I must admit I absolutely loved Richard Harris's performance as English Bob. And his constant spitting about the Queen and how you don't deserve a queen, she wouldn't even grace your horrible fested land and all that. I thought that was fantastic, but I love the fact that he had a biographer. In a weird way, it was almost like he was a celebrity, and like you just mentioned, it kind of taps into this wonderful theme of myth and the man behind the myth. Because again, in old Western, not to kind of hammer on with the same point, but I mean, it just does so much to sort of flip the script on how we've conceived Westerns over the years. But in the past, you've had this idea of the myth, the man, the sort of urban legend of the dangerous man out on the fringes of society who is not to be messed with because he's killed X amount of people, he's a dangerous rebel. And you kind of have that idea built up with English Bob, but like you say, when it comes down to it, he is. The man behind the myth is nothing like that, and it is just talk. And when it boils down to action, there's none there with English Bob. He is basically a sniveling coward who has built up this reputation to kind of hide that. And it kind of it is, in a weird way, it sort of pokes holes in the whole macho bravado of the idea of having a myth to a person.
It's interesting the way that William Money's also a counterpoint to that, because English Bob was a fraud, he didn't do all these things, whereas William Money did, and there's no escaping that. William Money is a character who did shoot many, many people, who did kill many people in cold blood, and yet he's not someone who considers himself in this kind of celebrity way that English Bob does. English Bob puts across the fact that, I've killed so many people in this city, I shot this person and did this and did that, and he's proud of it and, speaks of it with confidence and uses it as kind of a tool to be charming and feared. Whereas William Money, having done all these things, not being a fraud, he's haunted by these things. And that's, I mean, that kind of contrast, that juxtaposition between William Money and English Bob, though they never actually meet in the film, the two characters are kept totally separate. Like, it's a really interesting counterpoint, the fact that he is haunted, quite literally haunted. I mean, there's a scene where he's essentially talking about being haunted by a ghost of someone that he killed in his former life, you know. I think it's a really interesting cowboy, the fact that, you know, he's not bragging about this. He doesn't look back on this with pride or nostalgia. Instead, a lot of the conversations that he has with his partner, he's talking about the regrets he has over it and how he'd go back and wouldn't do the same thing over and over again. He'd have lived a different life if he had the choice now.
Well, it really is interesting that because English Bob and Will act the complete antithesis of each other, because, you know, you have English Bob, who really is just a bare bones man who wants to be the myth, and then you have this the myth of William Money, who really just wants to be a man. He just wants to be a farmer and a father to his children. He just wants to be a normal man, but yeah, he can't shake it. And I find that just a really interesting, like you said, interesting juxtaposition between the two. And it's kind of strange, but it's nice that they never meet, because it's kind of like, I don't know, I feel like it would have worked, it works better, the fact that they don't meet and that they don't share screen time, because it's two separate things, but you can see how they work with each other, against each other at the same time.
It's also interesting to mention it, like, as much as the film is kind of about, you know, how violence doesn't solve anything and about, you know, just like dissolving the Western myth, it never really, when it comes to its conclusion, hits you with a kind of moral purpose. I mean, it's a film that really walks in this kind of grey area between what's right and wrong, like, as you said, and as you felt at the start of the podcast, like you said. But by the time it comes to the end and the conclusion, you don't really know what has been achieved for any of these characters, and maybe that's the point, you know. No one has come out of this as a good guy, even though you do get the sense that William Money's on some kind of redemptive quest in going out and finding these killers, maybe in some kind of way, you know, killing them for the way that they've hurt a woman is sort of a way of dealing with the fact that his wife has died in a way. You know, he is dealing with some kind of redemptive issues here, and yet by the end of the film, I don't think he's really achieved any redemption.
No.
I still think that he's someone who doesn't forgive himself for his crimes and doesn't forgive himself for his actions, and maybe that's the point, but I think it's interesting that Unforgiven never hammers at home. You know, most films would end with a sort of moral purpose and a point and a message, but this one leaves it pretty up in the air.
Oh, I like the fact that it's ambiguous and it plays around with a lot of sort of grey areas. I mean, it's an interesting idea to think that when William's confronted towards the end of the film by Bill Daggett and his men, he has the opportunity, I guess, to kind of either be taken away or be punished by Daggett and his men. But in a sense, that kind of feels like maybe that's him allowing himself to be given the punishment he deserves for his past crimes. And in a weird way, I don't know if he actually wants to forgive himself. And I think that's what spurs him on. And that in itself causes a great conflict within the character, and it just makes it, it's such a great performance and a great character to watch.
Yeah, like mentioning the performance just briefly, I mean, Clint Eastwood was perfect for this film, and usually I'm a bit sceptical when directors will cast themselves, you know, as the lead role in their own film. But I think Clint Eastwood is just the only person who could do this, because we don't see any of William Money's past life, like flashbacks or anything, and we're only given any information in kind of between him and Ed, his partner. But we can totally visualize it all, because Clint Eastwood is so like famous and well renowned for playing the character that William Money was in a past life. You know, we are like in Unforgiven, you kind of get the sense you're watching the man with no name from, you know, Fistful of Dollars and The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly grown up. Like, it's just an older version of the characters that Clint Eastwood played throughout the 60s. And I think because of that, it just adds so much to that character of William Money. You know, like, you do feel like you know this guy, having already seen Clint Eastwood movies from the past. You don't even have to have that much exposition.
No, and I think that's a very, I mean, I know what you mean, it can be a little bit wary when a director does cast themselves, especially as a lead, you can think, okay, this is a good idea. But I think with this, it's the best idea that was implemented, because like you say, you already kind of have this sort of visual recognition, because recognition is not a word, recognition for who William Money could have been, and you've seen variations of that character. played by Clint, like you said, in the past, in the 60s. And I don't know, it just kind of already allots a sort of back history for the character already. And I think that's just, it's a very simple thing, but it works incredibly well because it saves having to, slodge through and actually go into flashbacks, which just wouldn't have worked with this film. And it manages to cut that out.
Yeah, it does. It's just such a clever choice by Clint Eastwood casting himself. You know, it sounds like something that would be kind of egotistical, but it's not at all. Like he's perfect for his own role in a way. And also, I mean, also great is Gene Hackman, who won an Oscar for this. And you know, like you said at the start of the film, and you said we come on to him, but for a bit, Little Bill is just someone who walks this real fine line between being a bad guy and a good guy. You know, he's the lawman in a town who doesn't want violence. You know, he puts a like an erected sign outside his town saying that fire alarms are not allowed in Big Whiskey, and yet he is this really dominating force within Big Whiskey. Who, you know, there's a scene where he takes the guns away from English Bob when he arrives, and then persists afterwards to beat the crap out of him, basically. And he does just constantly walk this line between being, you know, the lawman, the honorable guy, doing the right thing, and this complete psychopath, and he just delivers it so well, Gene Hackman.
He does because it's weird. It's kind of got a very cool charm about him. Like you can kind of, at first, initially, you can vibe with this guy being the sheriff because he has this sort of, and it comes from Hackman's performance, this sort of very personable demeanor in which he, as you say, is against violence and he kind of erects this ban against firearms in Big Whiskey, and he kind of seems like someone that wants to do right by the town and has good intentions, but then his intentions kind of become really blurred, and again that causes a great conflict in the character, and it makes you look at the character in different forms. Like you look at him from different angles, and that is mainly down to Hackman's performance. I mean, at points he's just so kind of eerily cool, and there's moments of tension in the film, especially like you mentioned him taking the guns off English Bob when he has instructed English Bob's biographer to hand him the gun back to him, and he's
Oh,
in the
that's
jail
like my
cell.
favorite moment in
And it's just
Unforgiven.
so tense because it's almost like mind games, and it racks the tension up and it just tightens it so well. And like you have no idea what his intentions are, what his purpose is, why he's instructed him to do this. And it's just fantastic. It's just the little things like that that make the film just really kind of stand out even further.
Yeah, I mean, he has a couple of lines with the biographer a little bit later on when he essentially steals English Bob's biographer. And again, it's one of those weird things. You know, he says in a scene with that biographer, you know, he hates assassins, he hates people of like quote unquote low character. He hates people like William Money and English Bob, and yet at the same time, he kind of is them in a way. You know, he is someone that likes the myth and likes the celebrity and is likes to tell stories and kind of be feared and, you know, also adored by his community. And it's just such an unpredictable character because you never really understand him or his intentions. As you rightly said a moment ago, it's at times he seems like he's doing the right thing. You know, he's trying to keep violence away from his town, but then he's such a chilling and violent man himself and who's prone to such sadistic behavior. It's just such an unpredictable character, and Gene Hackman is such an unpredictable performance from him as well. You know, he can be charming at one minute and then be so creepy the next.
Also makes you question the motives for like the ban on firearms. Is it really to protect the town, or is it really just to give him more power? Which I find interesting because then it kind of breaks down. Is he genuine about helping this community, or is he taking this position of power because it serves him? It's exactly that, a position of power. You know, it's just another fantastic sort of case of the anti-hero. I mean, if you're looking for a film with anti-heroes, Unforgiven is just going to reward you so much because there really is no clear cut, with maybe the exception of Delilah, there really is no clear cut good or bad guys. Everyone has a moral compass which kind of flickers back and forth. And I just love that. about it. You know, you've got these very similar characters on either side of the fence, but in their own rights sort of peel off to different areas, and it draws you in, and it makes you want to watch the characters you're seeing on screen even more.
Yeah, and that's another really good thing about the film. You know, this is a character film. This isn't a film that's driven by action scenes or set pieces. And it would feel kind of hypocritical if it was, you know, because this film is very much about, it's kind of very much an anti-violence film. It's instead delivered by great performances, great dialogue, and great characters. And that's what makes this film. And that's why I think a lot of people would be turned off by Unforgiven as well, you
Yeah.
know, because I mean, I will admit myself, I wasn't very much a fan of Unforgiven the first time I see it because I sort of expected that kind of film. I went in thinking, okay, revolutionist version of a Clint Eastwood Western, but instead it's a very dialogue-heavy, plot-driven film as opposed to, you know, one where saloons are shot up and, you know, people are chased on horses. There's only very quick flashes of violence, and the flashes of violence that you get aren't very exciting. In fact, they're quite difficult to watch. And it's such a great way to tell a story, and the perfect way to tell this kind of story with this kind of message.
I think also the flashes of violence you get, they're not just in there for like cosmetic or aesthetic reasons, you know. They are the conclusions to decisions made through the film and conclusions to how characters ended up on a certain path, you know. They are the ultimate result of all the dialogue and all the sort of character dissection. It's not just a quick case of, oh yeah, we need some gun shooting here and we need an explosion there. It kind of feels like it has a purpose every time it happens.
Yeah, it does, and it's interesting the way they've shot it as well because of that. You know, it's the most of them, I think, I believe, and I hope I'm right in saying this, but I didn't notice any kind of music with any of
No.
the violent scenes. They're not played in that kind of style. They're not supposed to be exciting. They are, as you said, that they are more about the characters that, you know, have made the decisions to get into this situation and about the moral dilemmas and the kind of grey areas that the action scenes kind of portray, if that makes any sense.
No, it makes perfect sense.
So it's just interesting the way that Clint Eastwood has directed this film as well. And it seems like he's got a clear idea of the fact, you know, he doesn't want to make an action scene. The action scenes, I mean, they are in inverted commas, are simply kind of, they are there to develop the characters and develop the story and develop the narrative.
What's interesting about them as well is the sort of reactions and the things that come after them. Like you touched on the Schofield kid and how he kind of has made up this sort of myth, this sort of bravado for himself that he has killed five men. You know, he's a killer, as he would have you know, and he's like a dead eye shot with his Schofield pistol. But when he finally comes around to actually killing somebody, it kind of dawns on him, and all of that bravado is just swept away. And you then see the sort of very real, very humbled, grounded reaction to what has happened to him when he finally does commit an act of violence and kill a man cold dead. He reflects really hard on it, and you see that, and that's something I thought that was fantastic. Because in so many westerns prior to this, back in the old days, you would shoot someone and that would be it. They would be dead. You maybe done it for a reason. You maybe haven't, but there would be no reflection on the sense that that person will no longer breathe anymore. They'll never get to see their kids anymore. They'll never get to see another sunrise. And that kind of goes through his head, and it really twists that character into a new place. And so, again, it's not just a case of having gunshots and fights and what have you for the sake of having them in there. It's a conclusion and it's a consequence, and it's a point in which the character can then sort of peel off and turn into something else, perhaps.
That's the great thing about Unforgiven. Like I said before, any of the violence in the film, it's not done in a proud, bravado way. Any of the characters that have participated in violence, with the exception of Little Bill, who is walking this real kind of grey area between what's right and wrong, all the characters who partake in violence regret it in some way or another. You know, they are people who will live with the deaths of these people. And as much as William Money in this one scene kind of says, you know, he agrees, okay, yeah, I killed two people at this time, Ned corrects him later on and said, you killed three people. You know, this is something that still lives with these people. They don't forget their faces, they don't forget the specifics. And you know, when they are reminiscing together, William and Ned, they do go into very specific detail. William very early on says, "Do you remember that drover I shot through the mouth and the teeth came out the back of the head?" And goes into very precise, intricate detail. And it's something that lives with them and haunts them, whereas, you know, characters like English Bob and the Schofield kid, who early on are shown to be, you know, proud of what they've done and boast about their killings and the crimes, and in reality it's not like that as we're presented in the film. In reality, you have to live with those decisions, like you said, you have to live with the consequences of what you've done and the way it's going to have affected families and affected people's lives, the things that you've committed. And, you know, these characters go on to regret that. And Schofield kid, he goes through a really interesting arc in his film, because he starts off as that, you know, bravado kind of little kid, but then by the end of it he's someone who doesn't really want this lifestyle. He's lived it now and he doesn't want any more of it. He's had enough.
Well, yeah, there's a wonderful line where he actually addresses Will and he says, "I don't want to be you, I don't want to be William Money." And it's kind of like you get the sense that, you know, you kind of feel relieved for him. You know, obviously he's kind of had to learn his lesson the hard way. He's had to get his hands dirty, but it's kind of snapped him out of this sort of fantasy of being this outlaw. And you kind of feel relieved for him because he seems like a good kid at heart. And you don't want him to kind of become what William Money once was. So when you hear that, you because you've spent so much time with this kid and you see him, like I say, he reflects so hard on what he's done and you see it sink in, and it just becomes like this great relief because you want this kid to do well and you kind of root for him in a weird way.
Yeah, I mean, he's a likable kid. James Woolvelt, I think it is, Woolvet, I think that's maybe how you pronounce it, who performs it, does a really good job because he never loses sight of the fact that, you know, this is just kind of an innocent young kid that is trying to fill, I think it's his uncle, he said.
Yeah.
I think he's just trying to kind of fill his uncle's boots and, you know, trying to make a name for himself. But then also under the surface, you know that he's going to William Money. He is a sort of a young William Money. He is that character. He wants to be, you know, the archetypal Western hero. But you realize, you know, when he's with William and Ned, that this is the life that he'll sort of come to regret in the future when he's grown up, and you do want him to escape it as much as he wants to be, you know, a cold-blooded killer that he kind of, you know, shot a Mexican that came at him with a knife, you know. Yeah. As much as he wants that lifestyle and that kind of myth, it's not what you want as an audience for him. You don't want him to go down that path. And it's an interesting way that it's played. I mean, you don't get that a lot in Westerns. You do want to see the hero, you know, being the one at the end of the day, stood there with the gun smoking, with like dead bodies around him, you know, who's saved the day and killed everyone and, you know, has brought justice. And it's interesting, in this film you have a completely different reaction to that. You want people to come out having not committed violence and, you know, and not be the hero, to be a normal person. It's a really interesting reaction that you have to the film.
Yeah, I just loved it. I think it was a fantastic pick. You've done another great job with your pick.
Thank you, Mal.
And I sincerely love it. It's a film that I've kind of had sort of in the back of my head, you know, as something to watch because I've heard people talk about it. It's been one of those films, but it's one that I never proactively approached to watching. So having to go through it for Film Club, it's been an absolute pleasure going through it because, like I said, literally from opening scene, that's me. I'm gripped. I'm involved, and the more the film moves, the more the characters change, the more their sort of intentions become blurred. Just the tighter I'm brought in for the ride, and I just really loved it. So, awesome pick, my friend.
Awesome. I'm really glad you enjoyed it. And of course, if anyone listening hasn't seen the film and this is the first time watching it, then let us know what you thought as well, and come over to our Facebook forum at Screen Invasion. Or tweet us. I think we're using the Twitter account now, aren't we?
Yeah, we took it over. We've hijacked it.
We hijacked the Twitter account at Invasion Radio on Twitter.
That's the one, yeah.
So if you've seen Unforgiven for the first time, or if you've just rewatched it and, you know, maybe you're like me and had a different reaction, then, you know, get in touch with us and let us know.
I was going to say, because of the very nature of it and the setting and the context of it, perhaps some people who have seen it prior maybe didn't like it at first, but gone back and seen it in a different light. You know, it's interesting to see how people view it, whether it's first time or multiple times or what have you.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I was someone who didn't like it first time and I came around to it, so I'm sure there's other people out there.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And as Dan said, tweet us or get over on the Facebook forums. Very simple, and we'd love to hear from you. Now,
We actually
seeing.
had a few tweets actually
Oh,
just
we
before we
did,
got to our
yes.
next section, and it'd be cool to write to read some of them out.
Oh, excellent.
Because I asked some people what they thought of Unforgiven this week, and we had Larval Hood, who said that Unforgiven is an excellent movie. He didn't think it was Clint Eastwood's best role though. And I don't know what it is. I asked on Twitter what everyone thought Clint Eastwood's best role might be, but I didn't really get any responses. I mean, what do you think, Mel? Do you think Unforgiven?
Yeah, I definitely think it's in there with one of his best performances. It's certainly just because of the many dimensions and dynamics that's going on with the character. It's just like so many of the other performances in the film, it's just a sheer joy to watch Clint. And we talked about him casting himself, and you know, I just think he's perfect for the role, and he just brings so much depth and different emotions to it. So yeah, definitely for me, one of my favorite Clint Eastwood performances.
Awesome. And we also got a tweet off Tony Hines, who said it's the best screenplay that Clint Eastwood's ever shot and called it a masterpiece. And I totally agree with that.
I would actually agree with that. I think it is probably one of his better. I mean, I like a lot of his directed films. Some of them can be a little bit iffy, but I think definitely in terms of a director's job, he's done a fantastic job with this as well.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah, so there you go. See, if you want your tweets read out, you know where to send them at Invasion Radio. Very simple. But seeing as we've had good, you know, we'd like to supplement and kind of balance things out by having some bad as well in a little segment we call Trash Bag Masterpiece. Now, seeing as it was your turn to pick the film, it's my turn to pick the stinking great big bit of cinematic trash. And
And you
it's.
have picked a
I
great
know,
bit
I've got
of
to
cinematic
admit,
trash.
not one to sort of blow my own trumpet, but I'm going to put modesty aside this week and I'm going to say I think I've done Trash Bag Masterpiece somewhat proud.
Usually we leave this as a bit of a secret, and you kind of surprise me with it, and then
Yeah.
I go away and watch the trailer. But this week, I think you got a little bit too excited and couldn't contain yourself, and I totally understand why, because this is something.
Dude, I found this yesterday and I watched the trailer. I watched it twice because at first I couldn't actually believe what I'd seen. And at first I genuinely thought it was a parody. Like I thought someone had made a parody trailer for a film that didn't exist. But then I watched it again and I did a bit of background reading and it is an actual film and it's done in a very serious manner. A well director slash visionary director as he's as known, James Nguyen. I can't even pronounce his surname. Nguyen? I
I
don't
think that's
know.
right, yeah.
I think the G's silent. James Nguyen, visionary director and master of the romantic thriller. Which I don't know who's told him that because it's certainly not true. The film that I'm talking about, if you don't know, be prepared to have your mind blown, by the way, for one of those films that's just so horrible that it's amazing. It's called Birdemic, Shock and Terror. Now, you have pandemics, you have epidemics, and apparently you also have birdemics. And the whole plot line to Birdemic is maybe a little familiar. I don't know. I mean, it sounds like an original idea to me. I don't know if you've heard of anything that maybe has done something similar. But it's about a town that is attacked by birds, as the
That sounds
title
like an
might
original
suggest.
concept to me.
I
I haven't
know.
heard of any Alfred Hitchcock films that sound like that.
I mean, if you're going to steal a film idea, steal it from someone that's maybe not as well known as Alfred Hitchcock. That's maybe just for starters. But I'm gonna put some audio clips into this because there are some moments of the narration on the trailer, which I'll put the full trailer up at the show notes at screeninvasion.com so you can go and watch. But some of the narration in the trailer is fantastic. It kind of feels like it's been spliced, like it's not done in one take, which is fair enough, but the editing work for the voice work alone is incredibly shonky. And at one point when because I gave Dan access to this trailer before because I just couldn't contain myself. I was like, he needs to see this before we go on air. And you
Yeah.
asked me the question, did the narrator just orgasm on the word passion? And if you listen carefully, I think he does. Maybe a little too wildly, but I mean, this film, it looks horrible in the most brilliant way. It's got terribly wooden acting. The dialogue is awful.
The dialogue is absolutely horrendous.
Just the whole story just seems ridiculous. I mean, it seems ridiculous because it's like it starts off with seagulls going a bit batshit crazy, and then all of a sudden, like hawks and eagles, and it's the most horrendous CGI work I've ever seen. Because the birds, literally, just you can tell they've been pasted on post-production, and they look really terrible. The texture and the rendering's awful, but they
There's
also.
a comment on YouTube by this guy called Luke Duke, underneath the trailer that says, if you look closely, you can see that the birds are fake. And I think that pretty much sums up how I feel about this trailer.
No shit. But the birds only seem to move in one direction. They sort of hover and flap their wings. There's
They
no
stay
sort of.
still. Like,
I
that's the
know.
most remarkable thing. Like, there's a couple of scenes where, like, they're flapping their wings, but they are literally just, like, staying still. Like, they don't get bigger or smaller to go into, like, the foreground, or, like, they don't move. They literally just stay still. And it's hilarious.
It is fantastic because they do literally still. It's in the one spot. It's like hovering constantly. They don't fly. They just hover. And there's a weird thing. I don't know. You might have to watch the trailer a couple of times to see this. But there is a scene where a bird lands on the floor and it explodes.
Yeah, no, it hits, doesn't it hit a petrol station, like, canister?
It hits something and it just explodes.
There's a car, like, parked at the petrol station, and the birds start attacking it, and then one flies into, like, the petrol station canister and then just explodes. It's like a load of black smoke, and it's like, what? What? Like, what? Is this bird flammable?
I'm telling you, James Newman, he's going to be attached to Angry Birds, the movie.
Oh my goodness.
With his wonderful CGI work. But there's something which I think is one of the most ridiculous things I've ever seen in a trailer or in a full film. There is, and this just gives you an example of the cheesy acting and the dialogue. There is a guy, the main character. It's about a budding couple who have to fight the birds, essentially. And the guy is this business worker, but he works in a cubicle. Now, bear in mind, it's a cubicle. It's not a desk of his own. It's not an office. Certainly not his own office or workspace. He is pretty much bottom of the rung in the business world of whatever he is inhabiting. And
Oh God, I know what you're gonna say, yeah.
he's talking to his friend and he says, "Oh, did the deal go through?" He goes, "Yes. How much? $1 million for my cubicle." And I'm
And then
like,
they high five,
they
like the
high
most casual
five
thing ever.
and there is an explosion sound when they high five. Just slotted in. Listen, I'm going to put some audio in for you guys right about now, and you can check it out, get a little taste of Birdemic Shock and Terror. But whatever you do, go and check out the trailer for the full experience. Believe me, it will be worth your time.
Meet Rod,
Hi.
A young software salesman on his way to achieving his Silicon Valley dream.
Thinking about opening up a green tech company.
Really?
Meet Natalie, a beautiful young fashion model driven by passion.
How big was the sale?
$1 million.
This is Birdemic. Chugga chugga chugga. My favorite part.
I know. It even has its own metal anthem. This is Birdemic. Brilliant. So yeah, there you go. That's this week's trash bag masterpiece, and it really does belong in the bin. It really has
It does, it does.
no other place for it. But now we've got Unforgiven out of the way. I don't mean it like that. That sounded terrible. Now we've watched Unforgiven. It's time for my pick, and I have been thinking kind of long and hard on how to follow this, and I've come up with this. So we're going from Big Whiskey, Wyoming, and we're going to cross the states to Austin, Texas, to
Ooh.
a film which is a big inspiration to me. And I thought this might be a big inspiration to any budding filmmakers that perhaps are listening to the show. Because we dissect films and we talk about films, but it came to my attention that perhaps, the people that might want to listen to this kind of thing are perhaps enrolled in a filmmaking course or have aspirations to be a filmmaker themselves, as I did myself at one point. I'm a failed filmmaker, hence why I do reviews. I'm just kidding. But I just thought this might be interesting to anybody who's actually pursuing perhaps filmmaking or perhaps writing, because it serves as a huge inspiration to me, but it also shows how you can make a fantastic film with a very little budget and just using what you have, and how you can take those very bare elements and kind of scrape together what is essentially a really good movie. It's another dialogue heavy movie, so if you know dialogue's not your thing, you might want to consider maybe missing this, but you shouldn't really, because it's a fantastic film. It's from 1991. And it's from one of my favourite directors, Richard Linklater, and the film...
I know what it is!
The film that I'm picking this week is Slacker, which, for me, it has no real plot, but it has plenty of characters, it has plenty of incredible dialogue, and it really does just show what you can do with very little and still make it a really interesting, engaging, and kind of provocative film. So yeah, Slacker, that is my pick.
Awesome choice. I was trying to figure out what you were talking about. I was like, is this a Kevin Smith movie? No, it can't be Kevin Smith. And then suddenly it all clicked when he said 1991, Richard Linklater. It's such a good choice. It is a great film.
And I do. I think it's if you haven't seen it before and you do have any interest in making films or the process or behind, you know, how films are put together, or even just from a creative standpoint, you know, if you are a creative person, you like putting things together and you have that kind of mindset, I think it serves as a great inspiration, because it is practically done on a shoestring budget, and it is just literally characters talking for a lot, but it's just the detail in the dialogue and the screenwriting and the performances is just fantastic. And I think as a film it works fantastic, but it also works really well as a kind of inspirational source as well. So there you go.
Awesome choice, Mel.
Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to seeing it, because I've not seen it for a couple of years.
No, I haven't seen it for a long time, so this is going to be really exciting. I'm glad you chose this one.
So there you go. All the way from Big Whiskey to Austin, Texas. Very different formats, genres, completely different, but, you know, it's films, and we love films. So there we go. Other than that, that's pretty much it. So you've got 2 weeks. Go get yourself a copy of Slacker, and go watch. And then let us know what you think over at the Facebook Film Club forums at screeninvasion.com, and of course on Twitter. And if you tweet us, you'll get your tweets read, which will be nice.
Of course.
And that is our Twitter address at Invasion Radio. And me and Dan are both manning that now, so if you want to just, you can feel free to just jump on and talk about whatever movies we've been watching, or if even you have any picks for the next public pick, which will be the next go around, let us know.
Of course, yeah, I'm really excited to see what people choose.
I'm
excited. We've got quite a lot in the lineup for our next public pick, and there's some really good stuff in there, so make sure you get your choices in and be in competition.
Exactly, and get your film put in the high-tech plastic tumbler of choice.
Exactly.
But until then, go watch Slacker, enjoy, and we'll see you on the boards and on Twitter.
They're not the dangerous animal. The human species is a dangerous, menacing, and terrifying animal.